Are you an entertainer? Do you like business and growing an enterprise? Maybe you prefer computers and electronics, engineering, graphic design, or marketing. Jobs in these areas and many more are available right now in the exciting field of radio and TV broadcasting. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and WORT invite you to the WBA Career and Job Fair on Wednesday, January 30th from 8:30 to 10:30 a.m. at the Concourse Hotel, 1 West Dayton Street, one block from the Capitol Square. Radio and television professionals from around the state will be there to meet with you and talk about the many opportunities available in broadcasting. Women and minorities are especially encouraged to attend. For information, call 1-800-236-1922 or visit wisconsin-broadcasters.org.
Hello, this is David Austin with the BBC News. Priyanka Gandhi Vadra, a member of India's foremost political dynasty, has formally joined the opposition campaign months ahead of general elections. Priyanka has been appointed as one of the general secretaries of India's Congress Party, whose president is her brother Rahul. Ambarasan Etirajan reports.
India's Grand World Party has ruled the country for nearly 50 years and it is synonymous with the Nehru-Gandhi family. Priyanka Gandhi had resisted previous attempts to get her into active politics, though she campaigned for her brother and mother, Sonia Gandhi. She has been a popular figure, drawing crowds during her campaign meetings. Her entry now, months before the crucial general elections, is expected to infuse fresh energy into the Congress campaign. Some view the move as the party's trump card to oust the Hindu nationalist Prime Minister Narendra Modi.
The Thai authorities have announced that the first general election since a military coup 5 years ago will be held on the 24th of March. The new constitution guarantees the military's proxy party all the upper house seats, in addition to any it may win in the popular vote. Jonathan Head reports.
After nearly 5 years of military rule and repeated delays, Thailand now has a confirmed date for an election which will restore some form of civilian government. A total of 100 political parties, many of them new, can now start campaigning. However, all eyes will be on Pheutai, the party whose government was ousted by the military and which has won every election held in the past 2 decades. Two of its popular former leaders, Thaksin Shinawat and his sister Yingluck, are in exile and banned from playing any part in the election.
Russia has again insisted it's in full compliance with a key arms control treaty dating back to the Cold War. The United States is due to pull out of the INF treaty because one class of Russian missiles breaches its terms. Jonathan Marcus has the details.
The Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty is surviving on borrowed time. The US is due to pull out of the key Cold War arms control agreement next month. Signed in 1987, it banned a whole category of ground-launched missiles with ranges of between 500 and 5,500 kilometres. The Russians now say that the weapon in question has been modified to reduce its range, though experts fear that such steps may well be reversible. The US has long insisted that Russia's adherence to the agreement must be full and verifiable.
Jonathan Marcus. China has denied knowledge of the whereabouts of the missing Australian novelist and former Chinese diplomat Yang Hingjun. The Australian authorities had asked Beijing for information on Mr. Yang, who disappeared while visiting China. Mr. Yang arrived in the Chinese city of Guangzhou on Saturday, but did not board a flight to Shanghai as expected. World News from the BBC.
It is Wednesday, January 23rd, and you've tuned into the 8 o'clock Buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning on the Buzz, I'll be speaking with Jerome Dillard. Jerome Dillard is the statewide director of Expo, ex-incarcerated people organizing. And today is a day of action to end mass supervision. They say mass supervision is not the solution to mass incarceration. It is a national day organized by the Gamaliel Network. There was an event today that has been rescheduled for a less snowy day, but Jerome will tell us about the new date. But today, January 23rd, a day of action to end mass supervision. And then later, I'll be speaking with Isabel Nunez. Isabel Nunez is a professor and director of the School of Education at Purdue University and is co-author of the book Worth Striking For, Why Teacher Education Policy is Every Teacher's Concern. So yesterday, Los Angeles teachers overwhelmingly approved a new contract. After a six-day strike in the second largest school district, the deal includes a 6% pay hike and a commitment to reduce class sizes over the next 4 years. Also, 600 new nursing positions over the next 3 years, and additional counselors and librarians were also part of the increase in support staff. Also, CBS News reporting that the district has agreed to support a cap on new charter schools. So stay tuned to hear from Isabel Nunez, where she writes when she learned that Alex Caputo Pearl was elected president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles in 2014. She knew that the children, families, and communities would soon have a newly energized and empowered defender of the teachers' union. So stay tuned to hear from Isabel Nunez. Also, I'll be speaking with Heidi Peltier. She is a research fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and her research focuses on the employment impacts of public and private investments, and her papers include The Job Opportunity Cost of War. She says education and healthcare create more than twice as many jobs as defense for the same level of spending, and clean energy and infrastructure create over 40% new jobs. By spending money on the military and homeland security, we lose opportunities to spend those funds on things like education, healthcare, infrastructure, and clean energy. So stay tuned to hear from Heidi Peltier. And then later, I'll be speaking with Josh Rubner. And Josh Rubner is the policy director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, and they are opposing the Senate Bill 1, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act. Josh Rubner, the author of the piece, Americans Have a Constitutional Right to Boycott Israel. So stay tuned to The Buzz this morning. It is snowing heavily out there. The Madison School District is closed, as well as surrounding school districts, Verona, Sun Prairie, Middleton, Cross Plains, and I understand all of the public school districts in Dane County. And also, it's day 32 of the government shutdown, and tomorrow the Senate is voting on two pieces of legislation. The president's proposal to spend $5.7 million on a wall, and a Democratic bill to fund the government through February 8th without a wall, neither expected to draw the 60 votes required to advance. Lots going on, lots to talk about. Stay tuned to The Buzz. We'll be right back.
Support for this program is provided by Madison Essentials, Southern Wisconsin's magazine 100% dedicated to covering local businesses, nonprofits, and people making a difference in our local communities. Now publishing 6 issues per year, providing fresh, local, compelling content every other month at over 200 convenient pickup spots or online at madisonessentials.com.
She's a rich girl, she don't try to hide it. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. He's a poor boy, empty as a pocket. Empty as a pocket with nothing to lose. Sing ta-na-na, ta-na-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. Ta-na-na, ta-na-na-na. She got diamonds on the soles of her shoes. 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 Diamonds on the soles of her shoes.
It's 10 minutes after 8, and joining me on the phone is Jerome Dillard. Jerome Dillard is the state director of Expo X Incarcerated People Organizing, a familiar voice in this program. The Expo interviews will be returning to the Wednesday Buzz in February. Today, January 23rd, is the Day of Action nationally to eliminate the use of mass supervision. Now, there was an event planned at the state capitol today. Jerome's going to let us know what's happening with that event. But good morning, Jerome.
Good morning. How are you, Jan?
I am warm and hope you are staying warm and dry, too. So this National Day, the Gamaliel Network sponsoring this Day of Action, can you talk about this problem? Mass supervision is not the solution to mass incarceration. And then there's a report coming out, and the event's been rescheduled. But this issue of mass supervision...
Well, to really go back on this, I remember my conversation with Michelle Alexander back in 2011 after her speech at the MLK celebration at the Capitol. And as we were talking, I was saying, yeah, we're going to bring this system of mass incarceration down. It must stop. It's more punitive, it's distant, connecting families, etc. And a comment was made to me that never left me, and that is, systems of oppression find a way of reproducing themselves or reinventing themselves, recreating themselves. And as we know, mass supervision, mass incarceration has been costly. It has been devastating on individuals and families. And something that's been going on in Wisconsin for the last 10 years, and that is the terms of supervision that individuals are getting at sentencing on top of the longer terms inside our correctional facilities. But today we have more people under supervision than ever before in the country. And I'm not going to go through a whole lot of numbers here. I know I just have a couple of minutes with you, Jen. But I do want to say mass supervision has individuals cycling in and out of our county jails, Milwaukee secure detention facilities, and has just been more devastating than mass incarceration itself, because it drains the hope of a total population. When you're cycling in and out of jail, or you can be taken into custody for any reason, it's draining, it's stressful, and it's doing the opposite of what corrections should be doing. And in Wisconsin, you lose time that you have on the streets. Say, for instance, you've been sentenced to 5 years, 10 years of extended supervision. You get to 4 years and 5 months, and if you're revocated for anything, they can take any amount or all of that time that you were successful in the community and start you all over again. That's a real problem, and I'm so happy that the Columbia University Justice Lab did an analysis of our system here in Wisconsin, and the report is eye-opening.
This report was going to be discussed today by Mark Rice at a event at the Capitol. Now, the event has been rescheduled for Wednesday, February 13th, and that is about the time we were going to be hearing you back here on the air with Expo interviews. Can you talk about when the event is, the rescheduled event? The event today at 10 has been canceled, correct?
Yes, that is correct. We're getting a blast out that due to the weather conditions, we had to cancel. Anytime Madison schools close, it's bad. So we had a phone conference this morning, and it was decided that individuals from coming from all over the state were merging onto the Capitol for the official release of this report, and for us to meet with our lawmakers to say, we have to do something with the excessive sentencing that's being done.
So the event the event is the 13th at 10 o'clock at the state capitol. Is that correct?
Well, tentatively, we do have to confirm that the space is available at the capitol, and we'll be having an event that evening, and we'll be getting that information out. Testimonies coming from individuals who are on community corrections in Wisconsin.
And that's when people can hear about the Columbia University Justice Lab report.
Yes, and absolutely. It is available online. The report has been released. Yesterday was the launch day, and today was the action.
I see.
And it's available online.
At their website, Columbia University Justice Lab, or where is the best place to look at it before the...
Well, the Rock Wisconsin campaign page would have it. And yes, you can find it at the Wisconsin... it's the Columbia University Justice Lab, the Wisconsin Community Correction Story is what it's titled.
Hey, thank you, Jerome. We've got to say so long. Today is a National Day of Action to End Mass Supervision. You can get the Wisconsin Story Report at the Columbia University Justice Lab, and tentatively the event rescheduled for the 13th of February, and we'll keep our listeners updated. Hey, thank you, Jerome Dillard, State Director of Expo X, Incarcerated Persons Organizing. We'll hear from you in February. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen. Have a good day.
You too. And it is 8:16. We are going to be joined now. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be joined by Isabel Nunez. And Isabel Nunez is at Purdue University, a professor and director of the School of Education there, co-author of What Worth Striking For, Why Education Policy is Every Teacher's Concerns, Lessons from Chicago. So we'll take a break.
In addition to the generous support of listener sponsors, the local businesses and organizations that underwrite WORT's programming play a vital role in the financial health of your community radio station. WORT is grateful for the support of our underwriters, and when you visit these businesses and organizations, please let them know that their support of WORT is appreciated. For information on how to become a WORT underwriter, contact me, Doug Holtz, at 608-256-2001 or visit our website at wortfm.org.
It's 8:18, and joining me by the phone is Isabel Nunez. She is a professor and director of the School of Education at Purdue University, co-author of Worth Striking For, Why Education Policy is Every Teacher's Concern, Lessons from Chicago. And she wrote a piece about the teacher strike in Los Angeles, excited about Alex Caputo Pearl, the president of the United Teachers of Los Angeles, elected in 2014, the Chicago teacher strike in 2012. All of this activity, she says, has her on the edge of my office chair. Good morning, Isabel Nunez. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hey, so the teacher strike in Los Angeles, contract approved yesterday after the six-day strike in the nation's second largest school district. Something of us described as a success, right? A 6% pay increase, a commitment to reduce class size and to add support services. What's your reaction to the outcome?
Oh, I'm very pleased with the outcome, not only because of the concessions won in the contract and the gains for students that are going to come from the practical implications, but also because the city as a whole stood behind LA's teachers, much like the city of Chicago stood behind Chicago's teachers in 2012. So it is yet another instance of teachers standing in solidarity and parents and communities and residents of a metropolitan area standing with them.
Can you talk about the organizers behind these two strikes? You write about Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis, also Alex Caputo-Pearl of the United Teachers of Los Angeles. This part of this, which you describe a nationwide wave of teacher activism and movement building.
Yes. So teachers' unions are changing. I mean, not every union in every district, but overall there is a shift toward what's called the social organizing model of teachers' unions, and away from the service model of teachers' union. So traditionally, in the service model, the teachers provide services, or the union provides services to the teachers. So they do, you know, collective bargaining on behalf of the teachers, and they will, defend a teacher whose job may be threatened. But they are considered kind of separate. You know, they are a separate entity. They provide services to the teachers who are recipients of those services. In the social organizing model of teachers' unions, the mindset is completely different. It is, we are the union, right? The teachers themselves are the union, as the whole body is the union. And the social organizing model, in addition to instilling this sense of collective power and solidarity, looks beyond even the working conditions of teachers and even schools as a whole to societal issues. So the strike teachers in LA were very clear that they were striking for their students and their communities, right? They were striking in defense of public education as a whole. And some of what actually came out in the new contract looks to this defense of public education, right, with the calling for a resolution on a smaller cap for charter schools. California has a pretty permissive policy for opening new charter schools, and so one of the things that the district agreed to do was to look at calling for a smaller cap on those.
You know, something that you said in your piece that you wrote about the teacher strike in L.A., and you were talking about the Chicago strike, you said, the strike taught me that resistance to the neoliberal project in education is possible. It's so succinct. Can you talk about that when you're talking about the cap on charter schools in Los Angeles? What do you mean by that?
So the term neoliberalism refers to a broad ideological, possibly project, but certainly, current reality, where kind of everything and everyone in society is evaluated on the basis of its economic value, right? So that schools are set up to be like businesses and in competition with each other, rather than a public good designed to serve everyone and to serve society as a whole, and human beings as well. Kind of individually, we see ourselves as market actors and as having value in terms of our contribution to the economy or our marketability and so. When we look at schools that way, then we look at test scores as something of a bottom line and not a reflection of what students are actually learning. We look at that as the product and not a measure of what we really want, which is student learning, right? We look to business style efficiencies in schools rather than how can we really do right by our students. So, charter schools are a big part of that. They are in a sense being used now to, you know, put traditional schools kind of, you know, on the run so that they step up their game, or at least that's the argument, right, is that if there's more competitions, then traditional public schools will do a better job. Unfortunately, since as a society as a whole, we under prioritize education in terms of funding and resourcing. When you set up competition among a variety of actors who are none of which are well resourced, then the kids overall get hurt. And so that's what's happening. I mean, it's not that all charter schools are bad, but when you take a very limited and, in fact, highly inadequate pool of public money devoted to education, and then further subdivide it among entities that are supposed to be in competition with each other, then it's very, very harmful.
Were you
and
this the resistance to this neoliberal project in education being possible? Are you surprised at the success of these strikes, not only just in Chicago and Los Angeles, but West Virginia, Kentucky, Oklahoma, North Carolina, Colorado, Arizona? Can you, what's do you think is driving this?
I think a recognition that model just doesn't work for education. It doesn't work for schools. That's not an appropriate way to look at schools. So not just teachers, but the families and communities that are supporting the teachers see that that competition isn't working, that actually children are being harmed when students don't have a strong neighborhood school that they can attend, right? I know that the idea of parental choice in education is very powerful, and I would never want to deny parents the choice to have their children educated in the way that they believe is right. However, a traditional public school that is well-resourced and thriving should always be one of those choices. And I think families and communities are realizing that competition among schools is not the way to get there, to ensure that every child has a neighborhood school that is that will serve them well.
Yes, you read about leadership, a united teaching force, support by the residents of the city and by the parents. I think all proved to be successful in resisting this. Hey, the pro-privatization forces in Los Angeles, that's big money, right? Can you talk about?
Oh yeah,
yeah. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's big money in Chicago too, right? So in both cities, there are powerful people on both sides of the political aisle, right? This has definitely been, in the past decade, a bipartisan effort to, honestly, it feels like dismantle public education as an enterprise, right? Luckily, that's changing a little bit now. Lots of prominent Democrats are issuing statements in support of the striking teachers, and that's all really good. But it hasn't been like that recently, and so there has been, you know, a lot of cooperation among not just national level political players, but local political players and the business community to to weaken public schools, to bring in more charter schools, and to some would say, you know, revitalize, others would say gentrify parts of the urban landscape. So schools become part of a larger project to reshape cities in a particular image, welcome in more professionals, more white middle class people, and displace the working class people of color who have been there.
And what I think is really important about what you point out in your piece talking about the Chicago and Los Angeles student strike, teacher strike, is that the Board of Education in Los Angeles waging a strategic public opinion battle to frame the striking teachers as selfish and out for their own gain. So that you have this movement of people who care about public education up against this big PR campaign.
It's true. And yeah, again, and the same thing happened in Chicago. So the big papers, the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, ran editorials that were critical of the teachers and critical of the strike. In Chicago, it was really interesting. So Karen Lewis and the mayor, Rahm Emanuel, are both very strong personalities, and they were to appear on a television show together and just were cursing at each other. like both of them were saying words that you cannot say on the air in the studio as they were, you know, about to be interviewed. But so yeah, the fight was the fight has been pretty intense and emotional. But despite the, you know, in LA, the incredible like $10 million almost that was spent to elect this this pro-privatization school board. And in Chicago, Rahm Emanuel was able to appoint the school board. They both had, you know, a lot of powerful media backing their story. But teachers, nevertheless, were able to communicate their message to the broader community and to really share their story of defending children, communities, and public schools.
So would you describe this action gaining more momentum beyond the places that we've discussed? I think next week teachers in Denver are likely to strike. Can you describe the momentum of this new activism?
Yeah, it's really exciting. It's wonderful to see. I'm pleased to see so many teachers recognizing that that we have power collectively, right? So Denver might be the next major metropolitan area to see a teacher strike next week. The issues are echoed, right, continually across these labor actions of resources and fair compensation for what is an incredibly challenging and very, very important job. It's good to see teachers realizing how many voices together they have.
Thank you. I'm speaking with Isabel Nunez. She is a professor and director of the School of Education at Purdue University, co-author of the book Worth Striking For, Why Education Policy is Every Teacher's Concern, Lessons from Chicago. It's great to speak with you this morning, Isabel Nunez. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
It is 8:32. We're going to take a break, and then joining me will be Heidi Peltier, and she is with the Political Economy Research Institute at University of Massachusetts Amherst. So stay with me.
Support for this program is provided by Crass Theater, presenting Mythical Creatures at the Bartell Theater, January 25th through February 9th. What if the wolf rejects Red Riding Hood? What if the boogeyman is real? 10 short plays answer these and other deep questions about mythical creatures from banshees to Medusa. More information and tickets are available at bartelltheater.org.
Civil War. I'm going green. podcast.
It is 8:34, and joining me by phone is Heidi Pelletier. She is a research fellow at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and her research focuses on the employment impacts of public and private investments. She is the author of the 2017 paper, Job Opportunity, Cost of War. She says education and healthcare creates more than twice as many jobs as defense for the same level of spending, while clean energy and infrastructure create over 40% more jobs. So she says by spending money on the military and homeland security, we lose the opportunity to spend those funds on other things like education, healthcare, infrastructure, or clean energy. Good morning, Heidi Pelletier. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm glad to have you on. So this, what caught my eye about this report is it really addresses that common, I think, belief, or at least messaging that we receive that increased military spending is a favorable strategy to create jobs. But your report spins that in the other direction, or not spin, it proves that is not true. This idea that is out there that increased military spending is our most politically favorable strategy. Can you comment on that first?
Sure. Well, you're absolutely right. There's this sort of common knowledge that military spending is good for the economy. And I'm not going to say it's bad for the economy, but what sort of got us started on a series of papers, the most recent one is the one you mentioned from 2017, is looking at the question of, is military spending the most effective way to create jobs? It does create jobs. We know that. And one of the reasons it's so politically popular is that there is support for military spending throughout the U.S. in all different congressional districts. There are industries that are related to the military, and so there's popular and political support for it. But when we look at the numbers, we find that that's actually not the most effective way to create jobs, that if we took the same level of spending, so whether we're talking about $1 million or $100 million or $1 billion, and shifted it from the military to these other areas that are also important for Americans, areas like education or healthcare or infrastructure repair and building or clean energy, all of those areas actually create more jobs dollar for dollar than military spending.
And so between 2001 and 2016, we spent $3.69 trillion, or about $230 billion per year, on war-related spending, and including Homeland Security, correct?
That's right. That's right. And the most recent estimate, so this paper is part of a project that comes out of Brown University called The Costs of War, and there are various types of costs of war that we can look at. But the most recent estimate was published a couple months ago, and you can look at the Brown University Cost of War project, and that's now over $5 trillion total that we've spent since 2001 on these various wars and Homeland Security.
So can you speak specifically on how many more jobs are created if the money were or in opportunity, job opportunities?
Sure. Well, okay, so if we spend money on defense, we're creating jobs in, for the military personnel themselves, we're creating jobs in weapons manufacturing and uniform manufacturing and all the support services and so on. And so when we look across the economy at all the industries, every $1 million we spend on defense creates an average of about 7 jobs. For every $1 million we spend on clean energy, we'd create about 10 jobs, or infrastructure also, we'd create about 10 jobs. So that's about 40% more than the same amount of spending in military. If we look at higher education, or even more so at elementary and secondary education, that is, in terms of kind of bang for the buck. Elementary and secondary education is where you get the most number of jobs for every million spent. And that's because most of the money is going to salaries and wages. So most of the money is going directly to pay for people as opposed to paying for equipment or going overseas to overseas contractors. So if you look specifically at elementary and secondary education, we get about 19 jobs. So we can compare the 19 jobs per million in schools to 7 jobs per million created through defense spending. We, over the course of the past 18 years that we've been at war, really, over the past 18 years, we've lost the opportunity to create 2, 3, 4 million additional jobs, depending on how those funds could have been channeled to alternative purposes. If they were channeled to education, we could have created 4 million more jobs than we did by spending it through war.
So when we hear critiques about government spending, whether it is used to tout military spending in the context of job creation or to not spend money on education, it's really who we are paying for. Is that part of your research? Or is it just really looking at the absolute numbers? Are you looking at why? And who's getting the money?
Why we're spending on military versus education?
Or who's getting the money? Because it's clearly not an opposition to spend the money. It's huge numbers. It's just who we're giving the money to, correct?
That's right. And the paper that I have written and the other papers in the past that I've written haven't looked specifically at that. But there's another group called the National Priorities Project that has looked into that, specifically into the question of contractors and military spending and the essentially the tax dollars that are going into profits for military contractors, as opposed to our tax dollars going to support teachers or healthcare workers or other people who could be benefiting from federal spending.
So when you point out with this research that you do over, it's sort of under the Watson Institute at Brown University, do people dispute your conclusions? What kind of scrutiny do you face when you point out the job opportunity cost of war?
The opposition that comes is mostly ideological. It's mostly the opposition to any notion of cutting defense expenditures. But the numbers are not really refutable. These are publicly available data that are gathered by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. They come from census data. They come from tax records. They come from public sources. So the data is very transparent. And so far, there has not been any attack of the numbers themselves. So any attack has just been, the notion that we shouldn't cut defense expenditures for any reason, and then there's plenty of evidence on the other side that says there are places where we can cut defense or military or homeland security spending where we have redundancies, where we have money going to weapon systems that are incredibly over budget and not getting off the ground, and that there are opportunities to cut defense spending with no negative consequences for actual security.
And then meanwhile, the kinds of jobs that are created when it is directed towards education and healthcare and clean energy, we're talking about an infrastructure, right? Just retrofitting old systems and so forth. We're talking about jobs that do essential things, right?
That's right. And one of the things about if we think about funding education or funding healthcare or even infrastructure, is we're going to have consistent, continuing demands for education and for healthcare. We will always need a healthcare system. We will always need repairs to education. We will always need teachers. And so this is an ongoing thing that if we prioritize federal funding or other types of government funding for these areas, this is a sustainable way to keep jobs going. As opposed to defense spending, really to keep defense-related jobs going, you have to consistently be at war. That's something I wanted to point out to your listeners that you know, boosting the economy by spending on defense means we have to continuously come up with reasons for going to war or staying in war zones, as opposed to shifting some of that funding into healthcare or education or infrastructure repair or clean energy, where there is an ongoing need that will happen in peacetime.
No, that is, I almost feel like I need to not follow up with anything, because that is the most important point. But I did want to ask again, to this data that you were looking at did include Homeland Security's funding as well, right?
That's right, yes.
So I think that's important, that your paper, Job Opportunity for the Cost of War, you say by spending money on the military and Homeland Security, we lose the opportunity to spend more funds on other things like education and healthcare infrastructure and clean energy. Are you working on a new report?
I am not, but I intend to. I try to update this paper or some version of this paper every couple of years, because I think it's important for us to have the data, and it's important for us to really think about what are our priorities as a nation, where do we want to be spending our tax dollars, how do we want our government to be serving us, and I think it's important to keep putting out this the data and the evidence that shows that defense spending, outside of ideological reasons, defense spending is not the most effective way to prop up the economy.
Yes, thank you for this, and these are the facts.
That's right.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm speaking with Heidi Pelletier, and she is a research fellow at the Policy Economy Research Institute at University of Massachusetts Amherst. Also, this work with the Watson Institute at Brown University, and you can look for her paper, Job Opportunity, Cost of War, and the other data as well. Thank you, Heidi Pelletier, for speaking with me this morning.
Thank you so much.
Hey, it's 8:46, and we're going to take a break. And then coming back, joining me will be Josh Rubner from the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. So stay with me.
WORT is looking for friendly voices to answer phones during our Winter Pledge Drive, February 25th through March 10th. For the drive to be a success, we need volunteers with neat handwriting, good attention to detail, and keen hearing. Pledge phone answerers are needed for 2 and 3 hour shifts during daytime and evening hours. Give WORT a few hours of your time, and in return, we will provide you with lots of fun and tasty treats. To help the station and join the fun, sign up directly via our website, wortfm.org, then click on the Pledge Drive phone shifts icon. Gathering volunteer power to sustain free and independent broadcasting for future generations, this is WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
A former talk show host, everybody knows his name.
It is 8:48, and joining me on the phone is Josh Rubner. Josh Rubner is a former analyst in Middle East Affairs at Congressional Research Service, a federal government agency providing members of Congress with policy analysis. Josh Rubner, now the policy director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. The U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights opposing Senate Bill 1, the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, and Josh Rubner, the author of the piece, Americans Have a Constitutional Right to Boycott Israel. Good morning, Josh Rubner. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Jan. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, Josh, an update about where Senate Bill is now in all of this shutdown. Last year, the Senate Bill 170, this one, the first Senate bill introduced. Where is Senate Bill 1? And, you know, that it got introduced during these times is indicating the priority this bill has among some senators.
It's quite amazing, actually, that in the midst of the longest ever U.S. government shutdown, you have Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell trying to bring this bill to a vote not once, not twice, but three times, actually, and marking this as the highest priority of the Republican-controlled Senate to pass a bill that attempts to encourage states to punish people and penalize them for engaging in human rights boycotts on behalf of Palestinian rights. It's simply an amazing statement about the priorities of this Republican-controlled Senate.
So say more about what this bill would give state and local governments the authority to do, including imprison, right?
Well, this one doesn't include imprisonment. This was a bill that was introduced and defeated in the previous Congress. But what this bill does is that it encourages states and localities to enact laws that, in essence, prohibit people from procuring government contracts with the local or state government if they do not certify that they don't boycott for Palestinian rights. And these types of laws have been passed in now about half of the states, and they've had dramatic consequences for people who do, out of their political, moral, religious convictions, boycott for Palestinian rights. And there were two cases filed by the ACLU in Kansas and in Arizona in which individuals who had contracts with the state to do teacher training programs and to have contracts for indigent clients for legal services, these people were cut off from their contracts and their professional welfare because they supported boycotting for Palestinian rights. And judges in Arizona and in Kansas ruled that these types of laws that Senator Marco Rubio is now trying to ram through the Senate are unconstitutional because it takes away our First Amendment right to engage in these types of boycotts.
So say more about how these laws, and there are 26 states now that have enacted some version, I understand, 26 states to punish or otherwise sanction those who participate or support a boycott of Israel, and legislation pending in at least 13 additional states. What are people being punished for doing?
So basically the way it works in most of these state laws is that if you have a contract with the state, you have to sign a certification that you do not engage in boycotts for Palestinian rights. And if you refuse to sign that certification based on your political, ethical, religious convictions, then you will be ineligible to receive a contract from the state. And this has played out to ludicrous consequences. I mean, for example, in the Texas city of Dickinson after Hurricane Harvey a couple years ago, in order to get state aid and local aid from hurricane damages, you have to sign a certification that you did not boycott for Palestinian rights. These were individual homeowners and individual businesses that were impacted by the hurricane, and they had to sign a statement saying that, no, I don't boycott for Palestinian rights, in order to receive governmental help for something completely unrelated. That's the farce to which these types of laws have extended, and they have real ramifications for people who do boycott for Palestinian rights, as these lawsuits have shown. And in addition to the two lawsuits that have already been adjudicated in Kansas and in Arizona. There are now five additional lawsuits in Texas, Arkansas, and Maryland against these types of laws as well. And so, you know, individuals who do contract with the state and who engage in boycott for Palestinian rights are suffering very real ramifications from these laws.
And so depending upon the state, it isn't just some kind of business entity contracting with the state, but if you work for a local government, if you want to receive services from the government, that you would have to attest that you are not boycotting, just in something completely unrelated.
Basically, anything that you would have to sign a contract with a government agency to do. And so, for example, these types of laws have been used to prevent people from judging high school debate tournaments, for example, because the proposed judge supports boycotting for Palestinian rights. So, you know, from the major, in terms of losing a governmental contract for long-term work, like Mick Jordal, the Arizona lawyer, whose contract for state services were severed as a result of his support for Palestinian boycotts, you know, up to the more mundane, everyday type of things like judging debate competitions. Everything is really being impacted by these unconstitutional laws that Senator Rubio is now trying to encourage more states to engage in.
Now, there are two bills that are going to be introduced on Thursday to end the shutdown, not expected to have the 60 votes needed to move it forward. Is S1, where is it? You said it was introduced three times already, and can you give us the latest?
Sure. So Senator McConnell brought this to what's called a cloture vote, which requires 60 votes in the Senate, and it's basically a procedural vote that enables the Senate to then proceed to an actual debate and a vote on the substance of the bill. So that vote was brought up three times. Almost the entire Democratic caucus in the Senate voted to prevent the motion from going forward and for the bill getting an actual vote. And it doesn't look like he's going to bring it up for another vote until after the government shutdown is over, but it is very, very possible that he'll bring it up for a vote soon thereafter.
Now, the new bill, S1 as opposed to S170, does it include criminal penalties? You said it does not include prison. So is it criminal, or what's the nature of the penalty under the new proposal?
The nature of the penalty is barring people from engaging in government contracts if they support boycotting for Palestinian rights. And it also includes a provision to encourage states to divest assets from any company that supports boycotting for Palestinian rights.
And, you know, we're talking about this Israel Anti-Boycott Act, Senate Bill 1, the argument infringing on people's First Amendment right to boycott, divest, and to the sanctions. Can you talk about, in the few minutes we have remaining, you know, about the boycott, about boycott, divestment, and sanctions for Palestinian freedom, justice, and equality?
Sure, that's a great question. And oftentimes when these bills are brought up, you know, we get into a trap of talking about the constitutionality of these bills. And while that's very important, it's also very important to realize why people around the world are engaging in these types of boycott, divestment campaigns. In 2005, 170 Palestinian civil society organizations came together to issue this call for people of conscience around the world to engage in campaigns of boycott, divestment, and sanctions to promote Palestinians' long-denied human rights. And this is a campaign that has really taken off around the globe, including here in the United States. On our website, uscpr.org, there's a list of more than 250 boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaigns victories in the United States, and these have ranged from dozens of college campuses passing resolutions calling on their universities to divest assets from companies that support Israeli military occupation, to churches passing resolutions boycotting Israeli settlement products, to academic associations calling for the boycott of their counterparts in terms of Israeli academic associations, and the list goes on and on. Academy Award winners, Grammy Award winners, NFL football players boycotting propaganda trips to Israel. It's really caught fire, and now we even have some members of Congress, new members of Congress, who support this BDS movement as well. So it's a movement that is burgeoning, that's catching fire, and that is really putting pressure on Israel to end its separate and unequal regime toward the Palestinians.
See, there is, I think, a powerful anti-BDS sort of public relation campaign for people who are getting that kind of information. Where do they look for the facts?
I would suggest going to the website of the Palestinian-led BDS movement, which is bdsmovement.net, and also to our website, U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, which is uscpr.org.
Thank you very much. I'm speaking with Josh Rubner, a former analyst in Middle East Affairs at the Congressional Research Service, now the policy director at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. And so Senate Bill 1, Josh, you think it will not be coming up again until after the shutdown? Is that, and for folks to just kind of keep an eye on that?
I think that's right, but it could be voted on again at any time. So please contact your senators to oppose.
Thank you very much, Josh Rubner. And hey, thank you very much for tuning in today. Thank you to Dave Lawrenson, our music producer and engineer. I'm coming up next, Back to the Country. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I'll talk with you next week.
The time is 9 o'clock, and you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison, Wisconsin, your listener-sponsored community radio. Up next, insert your radio kiosk, and then back to the country.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, January 23rd.
On Election Day 2018, an overwhelming majority of voters in Florida, 65%, approved a state constitutional amendment to restore the right to vote to most people who have been convicted of felonies and completed their sentence. And now, I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. Even though that constitutional amendment, called Amendment 4, was supposed to automatically go into effect on January 8th and allow former felons to register to vote just like everyone else, the new governor, Ron DeSantis, has claimed that Amendment 4 can't take effect until the legislature, which doesn't even meet till March, approves implementing language. Advocates dispute that, pointing to the fact that nothing in the constitutional amendment itself indicates that any legislation is required, although some local election officials who control voter rolls and procedures may be swayed by the governor's statement. In November 2018, more than 5 million Floridians voted in favor of Amendment 4. On that same election day, 1.5 million Floridians, the majority of whom are white and included 23% of the African-American community, were not allowed to vote because of that state's felony disenfranchisement rule that Amendment 4 repealed and reversed. The constitutional amendment and the overwhelming support for it means it's time, it's past time, for the right to vote to be honored